This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, February 21st, 2014. I'm Caleb Brown. Regime uncertainty is broadly the difficulty in believing that the law is the law. For businesses and individuals, such uncertainty makes it harder to plan. For the economy, it can be disastrous. Robert Higgs is a senior fellow in political economy at the Independent Institute and author of the classic Crisis and Leviathan, along with many other books. We spoke earlier this week about regime uncertainty, past and present.
In a very general sense, what can we say about economic interventions and their costs and benefits?
Well, I think we can say that there's always a presumption that the free market will allow a process to take place which produces the greatest net benefits for the public in general. And that doesn't mean that there's any kind of perfection about that process. It simply means that so-called imperfections that economists might identify in it are imperfections relative to a kind of ideal or a blackboard model of how an economy would best operate, but that blackboard model is not the same thing as the real world. So when it's used as the rationale for government intervention, very often those interventions do nothing more than make the market process itself operate more poorly in the service of consumers in general and the general public.
Interventions, at least within the United States, until very recently, broadly had the approval of Congress. That was, you had the president and Congress agreeing on something, and then it was carried out. In more recent years, this president, with respect to where he drops bombs and when, with respect to having a law become effective, specifically Obamacare, has largely ignored law. What does that mean specifically?
Well, I think the tendency toward a greater degree of executive discretion is one that goes back a long way in our history. And in general, the president in particular has acted with more and more discretion as a trend, not invariably, not every year compared to the preceding one, but as a trend, executive discretion has tended to grow probably for almost a century now. And on some occasions, for example, in the early years of the Roosevelt administration, the 1930s, a lot of executive discretion was employed, and some of it was struck down actually by the courts at the time and required reversals or passage of new legislation. Now, what we're seeing recently with Obama is another surge, as it were, laid on top of this upward trend in which the president has more or less ignored the terms of legislation, and particularly the Obamacare legislation, which is an enormous bill full of all kinds of special provisions of all sorts. And so the president has taken it upon himself to exempt particular firms or organizations from compliance, to delay deadlines, to change the terms that people are expected to comply with, and so forth. So there's a tremendous amount of discretion being exercised by the president, which would, on the face of it, appear to be simply defiance of the plain terms of the law. Now, he will get away with this as long as it's not effectively challenged in the courts, and no one will effectively challenge it in the courts unless there's enough public outcry to stimulate challenges. But right now we're seeing a lot of such discretion domestically. Now, if we look at the president's discretion in foreign affairs, it's always been much greater. The president has always been in a position where even in the absence of any authorization through legislation, the president has been able to effect fait accompli. If the president takes some action to provoke a foreign power, he can then create a pretext for responding on his own initiative. And no one has ever taken much objection to that historically. Now, it became so blatant and involved such huge defense activities in the post-World War II activity that more people have paid attention to it. But recently, as you mentioned, President Obama has simply undertaken to decide for himself where to bomb, when to bomb, whom to bomb. And now, of course, he has this notorious kill list of people that he and a handful of his advisors sit around and compile about people all over the world that they've simply decided to kill. That sort of presidential discretion is not, I would say, unprecedented, because in the past, there's certainly been a number of people killed abroad, especially at the president's order. But nonetheless, it has usually been quite covert in the past. And now it is, in a sense, more openly acknowledged that the president simply claims the power to kill anybody he wants to kill, whether it be an American citizen or a foreigner. And that, I think, is another jump in the level and seriousness of this kind of presidential discretion, because it reeks of complete despotism, of an absence of control of any kind. And I think a lot of people are now at pains to figure out what can be done to restrain this president from making himself the killer in chief of the world.
You wrote recently that government in general makes a mockery of the principal-agent relationship, specifically with respect to the NSA. Could you explain that a little bit?
Well, the whole theory of our government, and many other governments for that matter, is that the rulers are agents, that they're not simply divinely appointed or simply imposed on hapless and helpless subjects, but they are somehow selected or appointed in a way that makes them accountable. In the way that in a principal-agent relationship, the principal is the decision maker and the agent acts only on behalf of the principal with his approval and with accountability to him. We talk about consent of the governed. That's a phrase that goes back for centuries as a way of purporting to show that those of us who are subject to government dictates have agreed to be subject. It's always been a kind of myth, a kind of rationale more than a reality. We can very rarely find any historical situation or set of events and we could point to and say, well, that was when people gave their consent to be ruled in a certain way. And even if they had, as Lysander Spooner pointed out long ago in the 19th century, we didn't do it. The fact that two or three generations ago, or by this time, 8 or 10 generations ago, somebody gave consent to be ruled by a particular government or form of government, in no way should bind us. That's a very bizarre way to think that people give their consent without doing anything. Simply being born in a country, we somehow are supposed to have consented to be ruled by the people who have control of it politically. But nonetheless, that's the ancient theory on which representative government operates. Now, recently, particularly with the revelations about the scope of the NSA's surveillance of everybody, of virtually every form of electronic communications and other government departments exercising surveillance in other ways besides electronic surveillance, it's become very clear that not only do government agents not act as our agents, they act as agents of their superiors in the state exclusively, and they act adverse to our interests and without our permission, and indeed against our vociferous protest. but they don't really give a damn whether we like it or not. They've simply decided that they're going to watch every move we make, monitor every word we type on a keyboard, and if we don't like it, well, that's just tough. Well, if that's the situation, and I think it is, then the whole idea of representative government is obviously a mockery. The American people at large did not ask to be spied on as they are now being spied on, and yet they seem powerless to stop it because the people who have any political clout in our system are, for the most part, fine with this. They don't seem to be really worried about it. They keep repeating the same lame excuses for doing it about terrorist threats, and they just go merrily along their way. But I don't think any serious person could really excuse what's taking place and represent it to be an aspect of a sound principal-agent relationship between the ruled and the rulers.
As a related matter, you wrote not long ago that all government policies in the long run are successes, which of course is on its face a ridiculous statement.
Yes.
But what do you mean by that?
I mean that every government policy has an announced purpose. It purports to do this, that, or something else. But very rarely is that the real reason it's being done. If we take, for example, Obamacare, that purports to be a measure that serves the purpose of giving health care insurance to many people who currently lack that. But if you look at how it operates and in the terms of the legislation, it's perfectly obvious that this legislation serves the interests of a variety of powerful special interests. Insurance companies and government bureaucrats and various others, including even the IRS, which will be now in charge of enforcing and collecting the fines levied against people who don't purchase this insurance as the law requires. So a lot of people are going to benefit from the enforcement of the Obamacare legislation, but the benefits that are purported to be provided are at best an excuse for what is actually being done. And very often when we see any big complex statute, we can be absolutely certain that it's not serving the intended purpose, because the intended purpose could be served usually in a law that only took two or three pages instead of 1,500 or 2,000 pages. And if one plows through all these special provisions, what he's seeing are the actual beneficiaries of these laws. So I think people don't quite understand this, at least not many people do. Certainly the insiders have always understood it. But they're the ones who write these laws for their own purposes.
And therefore they're successful.
Absolutely. What I mean by government policies always working in the long run is that when they do not serve the interests of the special interests who create them and enforce them, then they're changed. People who have the power to make these laws, if they find the laws don't serve their purposes, they overturn them, amend them. They do something to make them serve their purposes. The government is not here to serve the public. The government is here to serve the people who have the power to influence what the government does.
A lot of your area of specialty and research is in the 1930s and 40s. Mm-hmm. What do people not understand about how that government under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, how that functioned? What do people not understand about the sort of the hard facts about how that government functioned?
Well, one of the things that's not well understood by the general public is this very factor we've been talking about, that the New Deal passed a lot of big legislation that purported to serve some great public interest. But in every case, these enactments were aimed at serving particular interests, special interests, people who had political power. And if we look at the big New Deal measures like the Agricultural Adjustment Act, it's clearly aimed at benefiting farmers at the expense of the general public by raising prices of farm commodities at a time when many people were struggling to even buy food to feed their families. Here's a law that aims to make the cost of living much more expensive for everybody. If we look at the National Industrial Recovery Act, it cartelized all the industries in the country, practically, more than 700 separate so-called codes of fair competition were approved by the government before the measure was overturned by the Supreme Court in 1935. But this is obviously another scheme put together industry by industry to suppress competition, to raise prices, and thereby to raise profits for the firms operating in these individual interests, industries at the expense of the consuming public in every case. So you know, the law was described as aimed at getting the country out of the depression. That was its public rationale. But the means of doing so boiled down to reducing supply brought to the market in more than 700 industries. In other words, you're going to get the country out of a situation where too little is being produced by producing even less. And it was absurd. And some people at the time realized it was absurd, but it had massive support by industrial interests. And then labor unions were bought off by being brought into the terms of the enactment and given new government support for their organization of unorganized workers. And so they bought into the system as well. When it was overturned, then the individual industries went back to less sweeping enactments to serve their interests in one industry after another, whether it was petroleum industry or the coal mining industry or some other. And similarly with the Agricultural Act, after it was struck down by the Supreme Court, new legislation was enacted to again serve the interests of farmers at the expense of the general public. So the New Deal was not in any sense aimed at serving the public. Every element of it was aimed at serving some special interest. And that's how these great comprehensive bills were put together. That's how tax legislation was enacted. That's how a whole host of actions were taken. And to some extent, that same thing happened again during the war when Roosevelt was president. At that time, the excuse in every case was that it was aimed at winning the war. But if we look at exactly the actions that were taken, we see that special interest consideration did not come to a halt during World War II. Politics did not come to a halt during World War II. And so the government continued to respond to special interest pressures, although not to the same degree that it had during the 1930s. There were some cases, I think, where we could legitimately say the government did X, Y, or Z because it thought that would hasten winning the war. But nonetheless, I think people don't understand the extent to which those overarching excuses for what the government is doing simply cover a variety of special interest measures.
You talk a lot about the business climate, sort of just the business confidence. Mm-hmm. Throughout the 1930s, what did that look like, and what was, in your view, sort of affecting business confidence?
Well, in the beginning, of course, the Depression itself was the overwhelming factor. Income and employment were falling very rapidly in the early 30s, and of course, that was distressing to practically every kind of business. The profits were falling for 4 years in a row in the early 30s. The net profits of all American corporations added up were negative. So of course, that's distressing to anybody in business, and many businesses, of course, just failed and went bankrupt. Some were seized by tax collectors and so forth. But when Roosevelt took over, a new kind of uncertainty began to develop, and that was because of these extraordinary government interventions that were being made. Some important interventions were made during Hoover's presidency as well, but the scope of intervention expanded a great deal once Roosevelt became president. And in the beginning, he tried to buy in, as I indicated in talking about the NIRA, he tried to buy in all the big interests, the business interests, the organized labor interests, the farmers who were organized, and so forth. That's usually referred to as the First New Deal and pertains to the actions taken during 1933 and 34. From 1935 on, the Roosevelt administration shifted course, more or less gave up on being friendly with government in general and investors in particular, and began to enact legislation that looked more like class warfare, particularly tax laws, securities laws, banking laws, a variety of legislation that simply scared businessmen, because we need to consider the context. Hitler's taken over the government of Germany. Mussolini's running Italy as a fascist dictatorship. Perfectly civilized countries are going to hell in terms of dictatorship. And so a lot of business people in the United States feared very sincerely that the same thing was going to happen in the United States, and that Roosevelt sought to make himself a dictator as much as Mussolini or Hitler were dictators. And that fear was exacerbated by the nature of the New Deal actions, particularly in 1935, 6, 7, and also exacerbated by the frequent changes of course. The New Deal went from trying to cartelize every business in the country for a couple of years to turning against business a few years later and mounting a jihad of antitrust action. Well, what are you supposed to think if you're running a business? What's the government going to do next? Are they going to tax us out of existence? Are they going to actually seize our property the way they seized all the monetary gold in the country? The businessmen were afraid that this government was capable of doing anything. And the president's rhetoric and his wild claims about economic royalists and his wars against them. He actually spoke openly and with pride about how he was at war with these businessmen and investors. And that had never happened before in American history. There had never been a president who went blatantly to war against investor and business interests in the same way that Roosevelt did. Now, remember, this is all laid on top of some businesses continuing to get special interest privileges from the government. So it's just a mess in terms of any particular businessman's being able to formulate secure expectations about what the future holds. And in the late 1930s, that uncertainty, which I call regime uncertainty, uncertainty about the status of private property rights in the future became quite extreme. And as a result, long-term private investment never came close to recovering in the 1930s, back to the level it had achieved in the 1920s. And that was a major reason for the continued duration of the Great Depression and for the high rates of unemployment that persisted.
Where are we now with respect to long-term private investment?
Well, it still hasn't recovered. Private investment has been the weakest element of the recovery since supposedly the recession ended in mid-2009. And, of course, there has been recovery. A real gross domestic product is now, higher than it was before the bust. Employment is not recovered fully. In fact, employment is 4 or 5 million persons in the private sector below where it was in 2007. So there's been a lag of employment and as you say, a lag of private investment, particularly the long-term type private investment, which is the most important driver of real economic growth. By expanding the capital stock and by implementing new technologies that are more productive than the old ones. So it doesn't really create recovery if, for example, the government spends a lot of money, because that's, in one way or another, regardless of what it purports to be, that's wealth redistribution. Whereas private investment is the means by which we become more productive in a real sense. Our actual wealth and standard of living can rise as a result. But we're still lagging there. And I believe that a major reason, and I'm not alone in this belief, many businessmen have voiced the same view, as have some economists eventually. I'm of the view that regime uncertainty is a serious problem now, and is one of the main reasons why the recovery has not already become complete at this point, including a recovery of private employment and of private long-term investment.
Robert Higgs is a senior fellow in political economy at the Independent Institute and author of the classic Crisis and Leviathan. Read more about American uncertainty on the rule of law at our website, cato.org.